Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
No more drinks for you.
Well, it's great to be here. It's a great scene here, great energy. So I'm really pleased to be part of this. I was really excited to be invited back to Ireland after my family had been invited to leave about 170 years ago. So it's a nice turn of events that allowed me to come back. Thanks to O'Vale, I think this amazing series you have. Thanks to Paul and to Rob for the job you're doing here. It's such a lively season, so much going on. I wish we didn't have to move on so quickly. People in the States, though, were a little bit shocked when I told them that I had a few readings here in Ireland. They thought that maybe the Anglo-Irish Bank had repossessed all the Irish poets or something and made them go to Germany or something. But what I told them is that there's so many Irish poets holding the important chairs in various American universities that there are spots left here in Ireland. Well, I want to read some poems from the most recent book, Dreaming Man Face Down. It's a book that's somewhat novelistic in its setup, so that there are these recurrent characters that, and you don't have to know all of this as you go through, but just it really deals with the theme of grief. One of the brothers dies, and so the voice that you typically hear is from the surviving brother, who's reflecting back. So the you who is being addressed is the other brother who's died. And this is not autobiographical, but it does involve some actual grief in my own life, but it's not drawn from exact details. So, just to start, I think there's nothing else I need to tell you with this first poem. Zilch. That never happened. It did, but it didn't matter. It happened in the time of blotto, of dust and nada. It was nothing much, nothing special. It was the season before the season of unknowing, the era of the over-answer, that everything came to naught. That was the time you were too busy with your skull, getting shrunken by the Swiss headman, Herr Mindfuck, the nocturnal European pygmy, who nodded sagely and said diddly in the still void of Rien. Then you started the old rumor, Arabs invented zero. What's with you? You never needed help to come up with nothing before. Beneath the null weight of nadir, of zip, of nil, the contours of your negative impression emerge. Never and never more a touch, an easy turning of the face. Everyone who dies adds to the power of zero. In your personal immensity, employee of the year, blank, down below you see it, us, like nothing, in the jostling light, the routine dew burned out in the yellow zigzag track of the day-drunk wasp. And they get more depressing after that. I'm trying to read the light ones, actually. So it's kind of fun to deal in poetry with what's often left to novels and creating characters and so forth. And so these two brothers, this is very much a lament, an elegy from the one brother to the brother who's died. But there's also, along with that, there's rivalry and so forth. So this is a poem about sexual jealousy. When she sang, she was anyone's, the untamed, glad young mezzo who would have what she wanted. And she was yours once, but not long, because for you she lacked the need to be possessed or to possess. Yes, she was a fish that swam in waters sweet or lightly salted, and she slept with any eel or trout or seal that made her cool or warm in season and pleased her. You learned her wants were always just a jump ahead of what everyone plus you could guess at or could attempt to intercept in the angle of her choosing. And when she slept with everyone, it made you feel abused. You tried to make her love me, as it was the type of pain you found amusing, until she went along, as you thought, but not to please you. She turned, eyes cool, fairly green, calm as Kant, critiquing reason, and I looked down to see we'd already begun to rise. I kissed her, or her, me, just inside the first ring of the inner city, while the night politely held its breath in a moment of unexpected tact. And now or then, she lives in Ghent or on the Ganges, and you live always inside time, where everything remains, but nothing can be recognized. I'll read one more, I guess, from this collection. These are longer poems. This one's in series. And it sort of connects with my next project. I want to read some new poems. So the title refers to what I'm trying to think about now. In this case, it reflects more on the afterlife, I guess. And I realize I didn't really agree with that idea, so I'll get to some other poems that dispute some of the claims made in this one. So it's in four short sections. You made eternity. 1. Folded Polaroid. You sat beneath the eucalyptus, hovering behind your eyelids, while you smoked up half a pack of Camels. You had it all, rain and the smoke sticking fragrantly to your camel-colored breathing. You were deep in your contentment, one of the supremes. Even then you were so post-neo, nearly fascist in formulating the definition of what made up the sublime. You held to, what was it, a fairly Egyptian notion of the ultimate, death as an opportunity for fulfillment, a lead-in to the extreme extreme. You taught me death. Life was the exception. I die because you die. 2. You only feared a second-hand dying, where you drift as gas through thrilling cosmic dust. You'd fan out in a flattened universe of echoes, annotated into the book of going out into the day. Neo-death. You taught me neo-death. We all wind up singing in the green basilicas of grass. We die because we were dead always before. 3. We know death, but you worry you'll be floating with the ones who think the proof of eternity is silence. Maybe they should just shut up and enjoy the quiet just this once. Can't they even enjoy neo-death? But tell me, can you hear it, the spherical music from your cell? You were no one to teach me life. Life compared to what? Once dead, stay dead. 4. You made eternity possible, beautiful, as it careens before us with specific beards of wheat, proper nouns, and rich options among birds. Even heaven's filled with more dead, lined up in corn rows, watching us and loving us, elbowing to wave to everyone on beatific monitors. Hello, son. Hello, my dear. I die because you said it's easy. Apparently, it's made for you. I beg you, reconsider. See, there's no life but life. That's enough of that. As I mentioned, or maybe I didn't complete the thought, what I'm trying to think about these days is the notion of eternity. And not that I have anything to pass on about any wisdom, it's just endlessly confusing to me, really, that the fact that we are at the same moment moving through time, and then we're also outside of time. So the one thing I read a lot to try to think about this, and what I like about it as a writing project, is that I never get any farther in my thoughts. I never have anything coherent to pass on, but it helps me get into a place that I like the writing that comes from it, where I'm basically meditating on how ignorant I am, I guess. So Wittgenstein is always a good person to quote. Quote that he has, I think, is helpful in this regard. It said, if one understands eternity as timelessness and not an unending time span, then eternal life is there for those who live in the present. So I'm also very bad at living in the present, but that's kind of what I'm shooting for, or at least trying to capture some of that. It seems to me that poetry, the lyric in particular, is well equipped to find those times where we can kind of escape time, or at least experience something of that other dimension that is always present, but which at least I rarely feel. So the poems don't necessarily, I give you this long background. I don't know if it's very helpful, actually, because the poems don't really address that head on, but they come out of that, so I think it'd be a good way for you to get oriented within these kind of strange poems. So the first one, inside the sleep of time. The sun's crazy and weeps when it falls on its knees, trying to run faster as it fails after noon. God, it hates how it shrivels in winter, right down to the withers. We, the people, live backwards to sunup. The greed upon earth rolls over toward Juno and Java. The greed upon limits sit snug in their sockets of fur. You roam like a monk, alone on a plane of your own making, broken open like last weekend, broken down like a truckload of turkeys. The Key Largo of nighttime leads on to the foot of the half moon, where the starlit refinery makes rainbows on waters, radiant stains from just distilled gas. High over the rivers were burning, the exhaust of your breath erases your face. In the fog, you see nothing but air. This poem, I told somebody, over the course of my life, I've met all kinds of these kind of crazy old men drinking around bonfires. And the person said, yeah, well, you spend too much time drinking around bonfires, of course you're going to meet that kind of character there. So this poem, there are these very vivid moments growing up where I would run into these characters and they're like half cracked, but they also seemed like they had something really important to impart, and I couldn't get what it was. So this poem is a reflection on that. In the ruins. All the poems have in, begin in something. In the ruins, we drank in the remains of ruined buildings, and we sat in a cave or wrecked houses on farms given back to the bank, listening to men who'd been raised in ways that were lost, and we strained to make out the use of their news. They were crazy or passed out speed notched with a cross. They drank from the flask and the mouth. They came in and shook off the rain, inflamed and dismayed, calm and arcane. The least one seethed, chanting Whitman for hours, then wept at the dregs of fire. Foam formed at the edge of their lips. We drank and waited for something to drop, you and I looking and sifting for signs written in wax. We were young, we knew how to die, but not how to last. A small man who claimed he was Blake raged all night, and probably he was. He had God in his sights. White crosses shone in our eyes, or acid mandalic. In the runes the men talked, seraphic and broken, glowing with gnosis and rubbish. We sorted their mad, sacred words, these dog-headed guides to the life after, and the life after that. So a poem in a different vein. This poem is more about kind of the opposite of actually knowing things that you don't know you know. And it's set where I come from, which is the north country of the United States, Minnesota, where it gets quite cold, there's lots of snow. In the blizzard, the horses are filthy in their winter coats, grubby and matted, manes mended with hay. They flicker between snows like medieval orders of spiritual pilgrims, seen and invisible, unseen and real. The blizzard continues and the world is the wind. Your eyes close to slits inside the drift and the howl. The horses aren't yours, not even broken to ride. Still, they help you get home as you look into the wind, seeing nothing but whiteness ahead, with them dark inside. These are mercifully shorter. They're about sonnet size. Read a few more. In the Dead Sea, clouds in waves, waves or clouds. They spin into rain and the air we live on. This is the way of the world that breaks from within. We suffer fools gladly inside the hole in the cloud, ecstatically beating the children, majestically eating hot cereal. The waves are waves of suns. The clouds in my blood run to the Dead Sea in my heart, deep caverns of blood, dead for the heart, a part lies like this sea below everything else. So another one in this territory that's, let's read it. In the barely unbearable, I fear most the most beautiful, the city up in flames, the chanting figure's hair on fire, our horizon lit with prophecies and wings of the tall birds who look out for us. I fear for those I love, the beauty that can harm them into seeing. I fear the girl, fear her feasting on the sight of seeing fire. fire I fear the most, fire I love the most, for the beauty of its loss is purity of fear. I fear most the most beautiful, the city struck with flames, the chanting figures mined on fire, the horizon filled with prophecies and wings, the large birds that clean up after us. I fear, I love the fear of fire. I fear the love of the loss of. I fear most the fire of the beauty I can't stand. Winding down. Red-winged blackbirds are in this. Do you have those here?
No, we have blackbirds.
These look like they are had insignias almost, and they're red, almost like a heart on both sides. And they're very common. They're in swamps. In the exit wound, blackbirds buzz the feral cat, praying. Praying is like not like this, but trying to. Blackbirds buzz the feral cat, praying at its station, the low-lying feeder, hearing the birds as food come down from the trees. The doe at our corn hangs still at the edge of the tree line. I read over and over the same page. Those who have gone come back by rearranging the words I misread as their names. The invisible isn't improved by the seen. Each day I don't see you, I see you. Head down, out in the garden, your hoarse end voice turned into the marsh notes of blackbirds. Listen, my red-winged companions, to the flowering wound of our exit. And to wrap it up, a couple on this side of things. In the end, we know without knowing, without need of tea leaves or cards, how badly this ends, how we shouldn't have loved the one over there or her, the one painted bird who for sure wasn't worth it, and you know you'd do it again in the flash of her thigh, in the back of the bathroom, all of it, the blow and the veil, the entire co-payment. We know we can't eat the calf that's been fatted, or the seed for next year. We went broke getting more than we could hold in our arms, even our eyes. It was losing ourselves in utterly breathing that made us so happy we forgot we could do it again. Cell phones are mobile, right? You guys all know. In a cell, it's all Sturm und mirrors. The self stuck inside its own cell block. The self left behind like a cell phone. The way you remember with your hands, patting your pockets. Goddamn. Left my phone in the cab. The self headed to the airport, unarmed, totally senseless, now laid into its tomb in the sky. Those who don't sleep watch TV for free on their phones. It's painfully clear it's all Zen on American Idol. The self traded in on a new famous model. From this point on, no one is no one. But back in the outer ring suburbs and ring roads, the self is stuck in its cell phone, repeating over and over, I'm not here, please leave a message. To wrap it up, last poem. So there, some of the poems I haven't read have to do with wheat. So where I live, it's right near the Great Plains, and there are these vast fields are splat there, right to the west of us. And as far as you can see, there's a crop, and wheat in particular is to me that looks as close as I can think of anything that actually can symbolize infinity. So wheat comes in and out of these poems, and this, I think, is the last poem right now of the manuscript. Inside the infinite head of wheat, the germ met the seed in the sex of the beast, come to devour the wheat's newly spun hymen and drink of its pollen. A bee swollen with spring and desire, ready to die by design when the job's done. The wheat's just begun to weave a shawl over the farms and sing a sad song into night. A night lit by barley and generous corn. The grains lifted in voice, they sing for tonight. They grow green, tomorrow they're threshed. Now they sway on one stem, bent at the waist, done, rehearsing their dirge. Thanks very much.